Some of that was not recorded. When you do an act of direct healing, you have to know what you're doing, because it's an act of direct magic, and it is a there are consequences involved in it.
Intervention.
Yes. If you meddle in people's lives, you're responsible for your meddling. And in order to do the direct healing in the Rosicrucian order, you have to be quite advanced, quite developed. For example, I can remember one time in life that I was allowed to do a direct healing while out of the body. And in such an occasion, I was allowed to handle the panacea, and you handle it with your hands, but not physically, like you're having jelly. You do it with the control magnetically, and it's like having liquid gold. And when you bring that to the individual, there is an etheric stuff that changes their etheric body, but that is the counterpart of what is taken from the realm of life spirit. And what is taken from the realm of life spirit is pure love wisdom. And so that we heal by making an effort, a special effort. We go beyond ourselves, literally beyond our selfhood. We go beyond ourselves, and we draw on that pure love, that pure wisdom. And in a healing prayer, you bring that through, and you can bring then to the person who is healed an understanding in a trice that they would normally gain over an entire life of suffering. That is how a miraculous healing is accomplished. It takes great effort, and it is not often that one can reach the realm of life spirit with full consciousness. I have not come anywhere near to that myself. All I was allowed, this was when I was very young in the path, and I probably needed encouragement, and I was still very, very pure. I hadn't had many struggles yet with the desire body. And handling that is something I'll never forget in my life. It's when I was living right here on the grounds and working, and I had the invisible helper experience. And, you know, now it's years removed, and I'm a different person from that. And I can begin to talk a little bit about things like that. The opportunities for crisis times. Often the greatest times are not always indicated by benefic conditions in the horoscope. Sometimes it's a crisis, like an initiation is much more likely to be in a trying situation than in a situation where everything is hunky-dory. A healing will as often or not be in a difficult crisis as in a benign astrological condition. Healing in the weather, for example, usually takes place under benign conditions, like if there's a drought for a long period of time. But we're getting way afield. You look for a real positive aspect, and then the drought will be healed. Okay. No, go ahead.
We got a whole bunch of questions.
So, to become an initiate, then you're saying, and I've heard this all over the place many times, that often it does come at a time of great stress.
Usually it does. Yes. An initiation is very much like the cosmoconception. And what happens to us when we are initiated is we go through the little death. And all of the things that normally occur, like the purgatorial realms and things like that, we experience during the process of initiation. Meaning to say, when we leave our body consciously, which is what an initiate is in the Rosicrucian sense, is someone who has the ability to leave the body consciously, you see as much of your past life as you have strength to bear. It's like a super retrospection. And the process is called being loved by Christ. And the act of retrospection is an act of love. And when you love, you're willing to sacrifice all of the negativity, all of the misthoughts and misdesires that you hold on to or that you carry with you and you identify with yourself. After you have done that and faced as much as you can psychologically bear, you have released a tremendous amount of soul power that has been stored up in the past experiences, and that soul power is then available to you. You are a free being, or a much more free being than you ever were before. With that soul power, you see yourself in your truest nature, and you see yourself in your divine selfhood, and you see yourself in the human spirit in relationship to the Christ, in relationship to the life spirit, which is the selfhood of all and the selfhood of the cosmos. And from that point on, you are acquainted with your past evolution. And with that past evolution, you can understand how the powers that are in your being are developing in you from things that we've done back in the Saturn period or the Polarian epoch or things like that. It usually is attuned to the days of the week. You go back to those things and you see how you're developing, and then from that you're given the ability to utilize the new power that's available to you. Everyone who is an initiate is a magician, and everyone who is an initiate is capable of healing and of other phenomena like that. They are not demonstrated that way. And in the final part of initiation, you're given almost like an assignment of a new problem or of the new step or stage. It's like music. You resolve from one chord into another chord, and you resolve into a new problem, and then that new problem, it becomes the basis of what you what you're going to do in the next initiation. So it's initiation is a small scale reliving of the entire creative process, but with great intensity and great magnification. Okay. Yeah, well, it's not as great as if I had lived through the initiation. I'm still a bit too chicken-hearted yet. It is said, if thou be Christ, help thyself. And meaning to say, are you willing to look at this that you did? And are you willing to look at this that you did? And it's not only looking at the imperfect manifestations of our being. One of the very difficult things is to look at the things about ourselves that are good, but to do it in such a way that there is absolutely no vanity, that we are clean, in that we are pure. And it's very much like in the book of Genesis, where the creation story is and the hierarchies work on something and they bring it to fruit and they can look back on it and say, and it was good. And if you can do that without, you know, saying, hey, I did it, you know, then, you know, because it's very hard. It's in some ways, it's harder to look at the good things that you've done because, you know, you realize you're imperfect and you just don't want to get back into all kinds of egoism. And so it takes a growth because being initiated is becoming a whole human being. By the time you have gone through the 9 lesser mysteries, you will have experienced everything that a human being experiences. Beyond that, you go beyond the human state into adeptship. You become more than that, but you become a whole human being. What we were intended to be in the first place. And what we're, you know, looking at people, they're glorious beings. They're really fine beings, but it is not yet what we were intended to be in the first place. You know, it's very much like that passage when St. Paul says, it's not clear what we're going to be yet, but whatever it's going to be like, it's going to be like him, referring to Christ. And so, all right. Maybe we should turn this in. So if we deprive someone of experience, then the responsibility for that falls on us. And we can't just remove an experience. Now, I'm not saying that doctors are all horrible beings. They're trying to do the best that they can do. When you're healing really, when we heal each other, it's a peer activity. And with peers, we're treating each other as equals, even though some doctors do like to play God. Sometimes I think you'd get the same result if you sent them half-time to butcher school and half-time to divinity school, but that's a little bit cynical. But what they're trying to do is give you a hand. Almost all healing, or all illness, I should say, is a matter of being imbalanced. You're out of tune. Everything begins with thoughts, and either we're sharp or we're flat. And the two kinds of sins, the sins of Lucifer and the sins of Satan, which some people give other names, some people call them harmonic, are when you're instigating or pushing too much, or you're holding back in the Saturnian sins. And one causes you to be cramped up and you're held back into all kinds of darkness and selfishness. The sins are so associated with the sins of commission and of omission. The luciferic sins, you are egged on to do things. And with the satanic sins, you are afraid to do something. Somebody could be, you know, it happens in the cities all the time.
People fall off the cliff.
Yes, yes. It's not my business. I'm not going to get involved. That person may be being mugged, but I'm not going to get involved. I'm going to stay clear of it. That's the flat sin rather than the sharp sin. And so what you're doing in the body, there are either hyper or hypo imbalances. The whole body is balances. Everything in the body is balances. They're called homeostatic balances. And so when we get out of balance, either something is exaggerated and hyperactive, or it is suppressed or depressed and it is hypoactive. So the majority of all medicinal healing is to try to reestablish the balance. And when you apply an herb or a homeopathic remedy, or even when you apply an allopathic drug, The whole idea is to establish the balance. And if you think about life as walking down a tightrope and you start getting out of balance, it's like when you help a little kid learn to drive a bicycle. They start to lose their balance and you hold them for a second until they get the feel of the balance and they go forward. And so when we're healing, it's a peer activity where we're helping each other to regain balance so that we can go forward. It is definitely not a process like fixing a car where you put in a part and take out a part and put in a part. That's not what it's all about. The balance, you know, all of the organs require balance.
You do that. You know, they take something up, they sew something up.
Yes, yeah. I went through a very long illness in which I lost a half a lung. And I tried to do it by Bible verses. I tried to, what was the Bible verse that I went by at first? I tried to do everything to take healing. Everything to the last straw. And it didn't work, and finally I had to go by, if thine eye offend thee, pluck it out. And
so you plucked it out.
I plucked it out. I must have, I don't know, I've got some of that swashbuckler in me, and I may have stabbed someone in the lung or something like that, but we won't go into the spiritual etiology of my illnesses. All right. So we're trying to get at what a human is, and we're saying that we're trying to get to healing, and we're trying to heal to make a person whole, and not just to remove a bad experience for them if that bad experience is something that is helpful. Now, to facilitate this introduction to what a human being is, and to use something as a pathway into the spiritual worlds, we've been using a very prosaic image that we come back to again and again and again. The image that we're looking at is a human on a horse next to a pine tree at the base of a rocky butte. And I guess to be whole people, when each of us has that image inside of us, those of us that are in male incarnations should probably see a woman riding the horse, whereas those of us that are in female incarnations should probably see a cowboy on the horse or something like that to maintain some kind of balance. We've come back to this image several times, and our observations have been very coarse, very gross, but they're simple. But every time we come back to them, we go a little deeper into the spirit and we're a little more sophisticated and we understand the cosmos a little better. Life in the evolutionary creation is like that. It's like composing music. If you break down a musical composition, take Beethoven, for example, who does wonderful things. He starts with very simple themes, really simple little melodies, and he turns them upside down and he plays them off against each other, and he does all sorts of things like that. Similarly, the cosmos is like that. It starts with very simple principles, and it combines simple with simple and simple until it becomes exceedingly manifest, exceedingly complex, ramified to many, many ends. The universal spirit works its way through nature and it repeats almost endlessly simple cycles again and again and again. Each time there is new experience because the conditions are slightly different, and we look at things on the basis of our past experience, so that gradually, very gradually, we bring something to perfection. in our consciousness and in our being, we're working on many things that we're bringing to perfection simultaneously. And then when we've brought something to perfection, we take it and we metamorphize it into a new kind of perfection. And this goes on eternally. It's like something we can never be bored with. The creation, it's continuous. It's ongoing. Well, this could be an awfully long talk unless I get moving here. Yeah, I got two more to go to yet today. And one of them could be a three-hour talk, but I don't think it's going to.
Which one?
The Shakespeare Tonight. I'll give people the option of whether they want a three-hour talk, and I don't think anyone will. The first distinction that we gained when we looked was that the plant, the animal, and the human had discrete bodies, and that those bodies lived, and that they grew, and some of them were capable of self-repair. That distinction led us into the etheric subdivision of the dense physical world. And we looked at the four states of dense physical matter that go beyond the chemicals, beyond the solids, liquids, and gases. We looked at the four ethers. We noted that the biological ethers were necessary for the maintenance of the physical body, and how the higher soul ethers were necessary for consciousness and doing things in higher worlds. Then we returned to the image again. In that time when we returned to the image, we noted that the horse and the humans not only had discrete living bodies, but that those bodies were detached from the macrocosmic body of the earth, whereas the plant was planted in the earth. Not only that, the human and animal bodies were capable of motion, and they were motivated to move. That led us into what Christian mystics call the desire world, which is a completely different world with completely different laws from the dense physical world. And we looked at some of those laws and some of those principles. We said that the worlds are usually named according to function. Then we discussed desires and moods and things like that. What we didn't do but could have done, we didn't say that when we talked about the reflecting ether, when we were talking about the vital body, we said that there was a special attunement between the reflecting ether and the mind, so that that thoughts made their way to the reflecting ether right away. It was like there was a vibratory attunement to them. We could have said the same thing about the light ether and the desire world. If you remember that the negative pole of the light ether is responsible for all coloration in the world. Everything that we see is color. The plumage of a bird, the color of a flower, that color that comes through the negative pole of the light ether is a resonance to the color in the desire world. In fact, in the four ethers, each of the four ethers but the life ether relates specifically to some other world. The reflecting ether is there to relate and to transmit thought into the physical world. And the light ether is there to transmit color into the physical world. Obviously, the chemical ether is there primarily for form, because that's what the physical world is all about. And only the life ether really relates specifically to the etheric world. It is life in its purest essence. It is life for living. We placed special attention on the principles and forces that work in the desire world. We talked about the principle of interest and indifference, and the forces of attraction and repulsion being activated by self-sacrifice and by self-assertion. We also spent a little bit of time, in fact, it's come up in several of the lectures, in all of the different kinds of lectures, talking about the quasi-autonomous lower nature that we have in the higher part of the desire body, which used to take care of us, and now it's our problem, it's our nemesis, and it is our necessary resistance. It is in struggling with our lower nature that we develop moral muscle, and that the desire body in the whole of our inner being allows us to perform some kind of internal isometric exercises. Remember the thing that made Charles Atlas so famous? He had the isometric exercises where you pushed one muscle against another and you didn't need any apparatus outside of yourself, that you could just flex your muscles by playing them off against each other. Well, that's what the lower nature did for our does for our whole body right now. We also discussed the fact that a lot of the mismotivations that we have, like desiring too much or too little of something, or desiring one kind of feeling to the absence of others or to the detriment of others, is one of the greatest of causes of ill health that we have. So now it's time to return to our image again. Only this time we have to be even more subtle. That's the way it is with the spiritual worlds. Every step inward is more subtle. Every step inward requires much more delicacy. It requires much more peace, and it requires much more discernment. The spiritual worlds are indeed very powerful, but they aren't spectacular. You know, like, it isn't like fireworks and things like that. Those things are there, but that's not the real essence. The real essence is subtlety. It is the sign of a master mechanic that the master mechanic can do things with the least amount of effort and utilize the greatest amount of mechanical advantage. And it isn't a matter of, I'm going to torque that wrench and really put it on there. That's gross kind of thinking. And that's not the way it is in the spiritual worlds. If we wish to be really spiritual and unfold the divine capacities we have in ourselves, we have to find the very subtle things in us. The will, which is the most subtle thing that we have, is so impossibly subtle that we can't even see it. We see everything into existence from the will, but we never even see the will itself. Now, when we return to the image and we're looking at the human and the horse, we don't see any obvious differences between the human and the horse. Most biologists would say that there is no difference. They would say the human and the horse are both animals. They would even go so far as to say that they have the same DNA, and that they say they share that same DNA with the tree. There's truth to that. You can't deny the facts of science. And it's analogous to things that the Bible says. The Bible says that there is one life. And that's certainly true. There is one vital, etheric life that everything shares. But even though biologically the horse and the human are alike, they're not alike in consciousness. Now that brings us to a difficulty. If we're not seers and we can't associate our consciousness and get inside the horse to understand what its consciousness is, we're in that terrible position where we have to trust the secondhand knowledge that comes from people who are seers. And that's something that takes a bit of discrimination, who you're going to trust. I find myself trusting very, very few people because I have one of those natures that when I give myself to something, I totally give myself to it, and I trust to the nth degree. I'm sort of like the clown in the Winter's Tale, that he, you know, he gets duped again and again. And so I have to be really careful about who I give my consciousness to. Socrates says that. He says, you don't give yourself to any teacher. He says, you know, if you've got a very fine horse, a thoroughbred horse, you don't give that to somebody that doesn't know how to take care of horses. And the same thing is with spiritual teachers. There's only a handful of people that I find to be thoroughly reliable and somebody that I can give my consciousness to, because if I give my consciousness to, I want to be open so that I can receive everything that they have to give. So we're in that place where we have to trust in second hand what comes from mystical seers. When we find trustable seers, they are pretty much in agreement. And it's a funny thing that mystics are considered to be outlandish by the general populace. But when you think about it, the mystics from all religions, from all times and ages, from all parts of the world, the mystics are more in agreement than a lot of scientists are. The scientists can't unify. They've got all of these very separative notions, and they can't do that. Now, there is one very simple, obvious thing that we can do without being seers like the mystics are. We can see that in the image, the human is riding the horse. That is, the human has tamed and trained and subjugated the animal so that it will do what the human wants it to do. If you think about it, wild horses just don't come up to a human and say, "Ride me." And not many animals take to domestication very easily, or to taming, or to training. It takes quite a good deal of effort to do that. We don't find many animals training humans. It just doesn't happen. It's always the human that trains the animal. Though sometimes the group spirit does have some things in there to say, yes, I'll agree with that. From this, we can obviously conclude that humans have a capacity that exceeds the capacity of animals, because we have been able to overcome almost every animal that there is. The mystic claims that the capacity that we have that distinguishes us from animals is the capacity of thought. Self-conscious thought. Self meaning a focus of divinity that is behind all the creation. When we think, we are thinking from a divine perspective. And in the process of thinking, we realize our divinity. And that thinking is what allows us to do all of the things that we do with plants and animals and minerals. When we say things like that, it doesn't mean that plants or animals or even minerals are without intelligence. That would be obviously untrue, because there's intelligence everywhere in the universe. The mystic would say that the intelligence that is in an animal is not due to a self, a divine being, but they claim that the intelligence is due to a group self, a group spirit, and that group spirit gives itself consciousness, it lends it to the animals so that the animals can be brought to the experience where eventually they can wake up to divinity within themselves. It's amazing. Let's pass on that. We'll get to some of those things in later talks. Fascinating as group spirits are, they're not the talk for today. Now, thought, or the stuff of thought, is another world. In the same way that the desire world is a different world from the world of stuff, the world of thought is a world that is different than the desire world. It's not a finer physical matter, it is a finer manifestation of the one stuff. It's completely different laws and principles, and we'll try to get to those in the course of this talk. We have to reiterate that thought is not the product of the brain. We experience thought in the body. We can think thoughts through our physical brain, but the origin of thought is not the brain. The origin of thought is in the mind. In order to understand spiritual realities like this, we have to rid ourselves of a lot of assumptions. There are plenty of indications of people who think and manifest individual intelligence without a brain, or with very little brain, or with brain damage. Now, what are the misconceptions we have about reality is the misconception about space. Currently, we think of space as emptiness. We think of it as a vacuum. That's not completely false, but it's certainly not true either. Space is something very different. Space is a potential, and it's a potential that's capable of receiving and bearing and sustaining a relationship, an abstract relationship that can become concretized within space. Matter doesn't have to be gross matter. Matter is congealed in space. So when we hear the word matter, it doesn't necessarily mean only this kind of stuff. It means the matter that is made out of feelings, which are a different kind of relationship in space, and it means the matter that is made out of thought, which is comprised of yet a different kind of relationship in space. desire, as we saw, wasn't subject to gravity. And it wasn't subject to electromagnetism. Thought isn't subject to either the principles of the etheric and physical realm or chemical realm, and it isn't subject to desire either. Thought has its own realm. All of the worlds that we're speaking of, the physical world, the desire world, and the world of thought, are emanations into space. They are relations that have the principles of the abstract ideas that have been projected or emanated into space, into the stuff of space, which we call cosmic root substance, but that's way beyond what we're trying to talk about now. And each of these realms has different laws, different dimensionalities, and a different state of consciousness. We've seen that the world of the dense physical world is a world of form. The vital world is a world of life. Each of them is a different state of reality. And then we have a world that is a world of emotion. Now we're looking at a world that is a world of thought. The universal spirit focuses itself into these different grades and qualities and states of reality through the mind. The mind is the focusing agency. Now, we don't want to spend too much talking about that, or we'll get really complicated very quickly. But let's go on instead and look at some of the more interesting notions that mystics have who experience the world of thought as objectively as we experience a stubbed toe. Mystics claim that being one step closer to the universal spirit, thought is more live. When we are in the first of the realms of pure spirit, the realms of life spirit, everything is alive. Not just in the sense that a plant lives, but spiritually alive. Like sometimes you know you're really living. Do you know what I mean? You're like, hey, I am alive. And the closer we get to the universal spirit, to the realms of pure spirit, the more live thoughts are, the more live our experiences are. Now, in the physical etheric world, things move at the speed of light. That's been demonstrated quite clearly. But we know that desires move much more swiftly than light in the physical etheric realms. Well, thoughts move much, much faster than that. But it takes us a while to be able to learn to deal with that. If we think about an infant has all the capacities of adults, but it takes a long time for it to develop and bring out all of those capacities so they can be used. And it's the same way with our mind. Our mind is in a very, very infantile state, much more infantile than the babies that we see around us. And so it takes a lot of patient application. We have to watch our mind continuously. We have to exercise it. We have to explore it. We have to develop a thought life. And it's slow, slow, slow. to do that despite the fact that the thoughts are so fast. Now, there's a funny thing. There are all kinds of paradoxes in this. The closer you get to the realms of pure spirit, the more paradox there is. Not only do thoughts, are thoughts more lively than desires, not only are they much faster, they are at the other extreme also. They endure much longer. If we take our physical body endures maybe 70, 80 years, something like that. And if we don't do anything with it, it decomposes rather quickly, and the bones take a little bit longer. But thoughts live an enormously long time, thousands and thousands of years, as we think of years. Even our very fleeting thoughts can be called back years later. And when we call those thoughts back after many years, they're just as live and just as real, and they're just as fresh as when they were new. Thoughts are like that.
Are you speaking of thought forms?
When you're getting to the thought and the form are they're so close to one, they're inseparable. Meaning and form, as one gets closer to the universal spirit, are about the same thing. So that by the time you get to the universal spirit, in the pure sense of pure spirit, in a realm of life spirit, there really aren't forms. And if they are, they have their...
You're dealing the abstract level of life.
No, we're still in the concrete yet.
Concrete
yes.
I have a good example of that. In 1980, I left New York City to go to a school about 30 miles away, and it was to study eurythmy, the art of movement. And in that, you study space and time. And we did this 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and you do it for 4 to 5 years. When I used to go visit a friend of mine in New York City who had an office on Park Avenue, who was also a very developed spiritual person, he was an MD, I used to say to him, coming from this environment, going into New York City was like going back 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And I had the right person to talk to this about because he knew exactly how to keep that conversation going, because it was kind of new for me. And the reason was, here I was up in Spring Valley studying all of this very alive life of thought. And when you come to New York City, you're still doing something they did in the old Roman days. Same singing, same 90-degree angles, same everything, same. It's what an experience.
Another quality about thought, since they are closer to this, is thoughts are not only alive, they are creative. Thoughts become something. Thoughts are like seeds that grow into full realities in our emotional life or full realities in our vital life. What we think is what we become. What we think is what we become. Some thoughts are especially detrimental to us. If we think, I can't do that, we are self-limiting. We are negating ourselves as far as our capacities. Behind everything, every action, every desire is a thought. This is exceedingly practical. Because if we have control of the thought process, we are at the root of everything that becomes manifest in our manifest being. And if we're at the root, we can then, you know, it's very much like John the Baptist says, the axe is laid to the root. And if you want to change your character, if you can change your thinking and sustain a new, clear, true, wholesome line of thought, if you can sustain that long enough, you become a different person. Because thoughts are closer to the universal spirit, they partake more of the qualities of the universal spirit. That is, they're more unified and they combine easier. Thus, the life, our entire lifetime, and everything in it, our body, is one single complex thought. It's very complex. It starts out with simple elements, but everything unifies. It's not like separative, like here. This room is separated from that room by a wall. Thoughts flow into each other, and they unify with each other to a common end. So the more we can combine our thoughts, the more we can bring them into a whole. Things in the spiritual worlds are in wholes and not like here in parts. Now, it's important because we're very infantile here that we look at this detailed part and we look at that detailed part, because we have to see objectively what the reality is that we're working with, and we have the only limited capacity for objectivity that requires detail. But when we start unfolding the mind, which is close to the spirit, we think in wholes. It is such that all of nature that we participate in is one huge thought. All of the history of what humanity is one large thought. And it isn't finished. Because it's live, it's metamorphic. We can change it. We can change history by our thinking. A lot of people try to do it by rough actions like warfare or something like that. But the most efficient way of changing history is by changing our thought. And when we do so, we effect things that can make it much better.
Aren't you affecting the future, not the history?
Well, the history is just the outlay of the future. We're talking about a timelessness when we're close to the mind, but I don't want to. I've already taken way too many side trips today, and I'm going to have to decline some of them, or this is going to be awfully long. In fact, there is one thought that is the divine thought, that is the thought of the Creator. Many hierarchies within the One have participated in that thought, but there is one thought that is the whole creation. And if you look at it, it is like we are, the little bit of independent thinking that we do is so minuscule, it's like interpretations. You know, when a composer writes a great piece of music, he leaves places in there for the instrumentalists to interpret it as they want to interpret. In some cases, they're even allowed to improvise into that. So everything that we do is really, really minuscule compared to the one big thought that is the divine plan of everything that is, and that is the basis of everything that's going to become. If we're going to grow spiritually, we have to realize that we are part of the spiritual creation, and that always we should be working on our creative capacities. Whether we know it or not, in between lives, consciously and unconsciously here, we work with angels, archangels, and other divine beings. We work on the creative thoughts of the cosmos. Therefore, the more we perfect our ability to think, the more we can really take part. We can participate. There's nothing that makes a person feel more a part of something than consciously participating in it and doing something right in it. Every time we come to rebirth, we exercise this capacity and we think our life into existence. And the sooner we awaken to that, the sooner we're going to go forward. If we have limiting conceptions of ourselves, we're putting ourselves asleep rather than waking ourselves. It's important to analyze which of our attitudes are like cosmic sleeping pills. Now, the thing of creative thinking, again, is not mind-boggling. It's not complex. It's much more in the other direction, as we've been saying so far this morning. It begins with very simple thoughts. It begins with a very simple process that allows you to go inward. One word is exceedingly important. Oh, I'm not going to make it. Concentration. With concentration, we can penetrate anything. With concentration, we can go inward to a divine center, and everything radiates out from us just as it does from the divine center of all being. Simple concentration. The more we can bring our thoughts to a point and go into the creative black hole of our existence, we can bring out universes if necessary. What we think is what we become. The heart is a garden where the thought flowers grow, and the thoughts that we think are the seeds that we sow. Each kind loving thought bears a kind loving deed, while a thought that is selfish is just like a weed. So let us plant our thought seeds so thick in a row, there will not be room for weed thoughts to grow. That's old poem from somebody that belonged to the Unity Church. Our thoughts are our creations, and as they associate together, they become our destiny. This it means health and healing. Behind every illness, be even a broken bone, there is a misthought or a broken thought line. The sooner we get control of our thought process and deepen it, I'm not saying that I think I'm being unclear here. We don't have to be intellectuals. We don't have to have all kinds of knowledge. We don't have to have all kinds of grandiose schemes. Somebody that can concentrate with the love of their heart is far more powerful as a creative person or as a healing person than someone who has all of this elaborate intellectual paraphernalia. It's just not necessary. If you have concentration and if you're in control of what you're concentrating on, so that you're certain that your concentration is bringing through something of love, that's the way to do things. If you have concentration, it's amazing how much can be done to change one's life in a very, very short time. We can undo millions of years of bad thinking that we have humans have had. We're still in the early stages yet, so we can still get it before it gets too far away from us. When we do healing prayer, some of us do it every day, some go to the temple every day, we have to go with a positive attitude that if we really concentrate and really give it all of our heart, that this might be the time that we bring down life spirit. There is no reason why we should doubt our capacity to do miracles. No reason at all. If we really concentrate, if we really put our heart into it, every time we sit down to pray, we should believe that it's possible. We should know that this might be the time. You anticipate it like a child anticipates a birthday party or a celebration. Or at Christmas when a child opens a present, it knows there's something good inside. We should have exactly that same feeling with healing prayers. Other people have done it, and there's no reason why we can't do it. St. Francis of Assisi did wonderful things. Not too long ago, Padre Pio was doing wonderful things. Max Heindel did amazing things. There's no reason that you and I can't do it. It's just a matter of work. And if we put in the concentrated work, we can do it. I don't want you to walk off with Pollyanna thoughts, because it's not easy. Nobody ever said the spiritual life was easier. It's probably much more difficult than the normal everyday life, but it's much more joyous. I've been at it, very close to 40 years, trying to perfect the concentration. And the process goes very, very slowly. It's hard work, and you can't let up. You can't take a vacation. It's like learning a new language. If you haven't had it before, if some things come to us naturally, those are things we've done in past lives. But if you're trying to make new growth and go forward, if you let up, it vanishes on you. I can say I've made precious little progress in my life. But the progress is real. And it's very dear to me. It's very, very dear, because there is a feeling of accomplishment that you have been able to take the body of God and do even some very little thing with it in terms of concentration. I can look back at my life and I can see that the sorrows that I suffered were a consequence of the attitudes, the thoughts that I was thinking at the time that I suffered. No doubt about it. Let's look at some other aspects of thinking. Again, mystics have very unusual notions about thought and thinking. First off, they think that thought is a matter of tone or a matter of pitch. Thinking is a matter of intoning and attuning. So like thinking is playing a musical instrument and attuning it to the cosmic perfect standard. At first this seems crazy, but our language and our culture is filled with it. We say it sounds true, or we say it has the ring of truth. Or last night we saw Autolycles as a con man pitching things. We call somebody who is a persuasive person a pitch man. And we say of someone's logical process, we say that is sound logic. And if you look about, you'll find that there are many more examples that in our language we take it for granted that language is associated with tone. Now, some of the other things that mystics claim about thinking are much more difficult, and they're odd. Mystics claim that concrete thinking is a process of evaluation. The claim is that in the region of concrete thought, which is filled with thought stuff of varying grades, that when we form a thought form, it's not like making something like a packing together and making a snowman, that we evacuate a form. We produce an emptiness. This is found in mythology. Like, for example, symbolically in mythology, a mountain is a high state of consciousness. A hollow mountain is a high state of consciousness that one can enter into and objectify one's thoughts and find all the treasures, the crystalline thoughts, Alibaba and the 40 thieves, for example. These voids resonate. And according to the nature of the thought and the thought stuff, they attract to them, to this resonant void, and this is how things come into existence in all the lower realms, the desire world as well as the physical etheric. It's very analogous to playing a flute or to playing a panpipe or something like that. So the attraction is by sound power in one part. We'll get to a much, in some ways, the worlds are like stuff that has been sucked into a gigantic void of concentration. The realms are like that. Now, how does this relate to thinking? This always has to be practical, and it has to relate to our experience. But if we watch ourselves when we're thinking, we're asking questions. Questions that we believe that there are answers for. The posture of asking a question, is it like this? Or in a deep prayer, Oh God, bring your light to this. In that asking, you're forming a very concentrated, you know, the question is a pleading to pull something into it. Into that, even when you're drawing, if you're imagining, you're pulling something together. It has a questioning attitude, which is an evacuating kind of consciousness. So all thinking really is a matter of questioning. We're seeking answers. And they're not only filled with matter, because thought stuff is subtle, but it lives in universal space. And that universal space is permeated with something even more rare than thought stuff. It's permeated with life spirit. Christ, when focusing from the realm of life spirit, says, I am the truth, saying that this is pure truth, not just a principle, which is a way that truth is abstractly expressed into lower realms, but the truth that is within all principles. Therefore, when we evacuate a thought form by forming an image and holding and having nothing in our mind but that image, the hollow form that we produce is evacuated of thought stuff, but it is pure truth. So it is exactly what happens when we are thinking. If we are thinking, our thoughts become vessels for the truth. And thinking is then exactly like music. When you're listening to music, there is a recognition of a kind of truth that can't even be verbalized. And that as the music changes, the truth remains constant, and the changes in the music, you're understanding the truth from different vantage points. Or if somebody is producing a sorites or some kind of complicated logical form argument that you follow step by step by step, you can see that it is the same truth, and you're understanding the truth through the forms that it is taking. So what mystics say about the process of thinking being an evacuative process is certainly true. So if we think of an idea, or if we think of a tone process, and that thinking is like listening, because when you're listening, that it's also a drawing, evacuative kind of consciousness. So thinking or being in touch with the cosmic thought is like a radio telescope. It's listening, but it is also an express power. You've seen the ads, I guess they're pretty old now, when Ella Fitzgerald would sing and shatter the glass. I think they were for some kind of recording tape or something like that. Consequently, if one is really listening, which is means opening one's mind, and one begins to look for subtleties, realizing that there are subtleties there, one can hear the music of the spheres. One can hear the reverberations of the one word in the so-called angelic hosannas. It requires subtlety, and it isn't like exactly like you hear with your ears. It's more like the truth that you hear when you hear music. Socrates was told to make music, and his making of music was thinking. And that process of thinking, like when you're hearing a harmony, like a divine harmony, you're understanding the relationship of one focus of truth to another focus of truth. Often our thought is more attunement than it is intonation. We don't all have perfected pitch. The divine beings have perfected pitch, that they represent certain true relationships, which we call theoretic harmonics, and that in our creative work, we are more mimickers, we are more apers, and what we do is we attune ourselves to what the cosmic thought is. Ooh. Ah, we're getting down there. We're almost finished, by golly. We had a lot of side trips, Gloria. We had a question and answer period at the beginning, which unfortunately was lost because I didn't turn the tape on right away. Somebody's going to have to remind me at each talk to make sure that the tape is on and running. So we are like apprentices in the process of creativity. Most of what we do is modifying the divine creation and mimicking what others do. So we are attuning our thoughts to archetypal thoughts, the archetypal thoughts of the divine beings who are more in touch with the one original thought. Sometimes we even copy the thoughts of other human beings. That's the way it worked for me. I had a friend, I lived with a composer. I was in my early 20s and I didn't know how to think, but he did. He thought creatively. I went to the university there and couldn't find what I wanted there. I went to the drug culture and I couldn't find what I wanted there. But this friend, when he thought, something happened. There was a realization of truth and there was a knowing. And I can remember when I had my first thought, I can remember the very spot that I was sitting, and it was one of the most glorious times in my life. It felt so good, it felt so light, both in seeing light, but being buoyant also. And it's like I learned by copying how to make that void, or how to create an emptiness that you wrap around the intuition that is a little corpuscle of life spirit. Now, so far we've only talked about very simple individual thoughts, which are like looking at individual notes in a score in a gigantic symphony. We said before, notes can be put together and they unite in lines of thought, which are what melodies are. And those lines of thought become themes, and they undergo thematic evolutions. And they become then something, a part of something even larger called the leitmotif in music. And they become movements in symphonies. So simple things like playing one note and then playing another note, that one note, especially if it is the key note, can be expanded in its relation to the one to become an entire symphony. Somebody like Mozart could hear a complex thought like a symphony at once. In an instant, the whole thing was there. And then to bring it into this world, out of the world of thought, was a very difficult thing. He had to delineate them. And you know what he would do? He would sit at a pool table or at a billiards table, and he would bounce the ball, and as the ball bounced around the billiard table, he would get ideas of how to take this complex whole thought and delineate it into something that could be a symphony. In fact, he even has the Dice Symphony. And because he recognized that certain great thematic ideas could be produced in different ways. And so he had the score such that the conductor could do it various different ways, the same piece of music, and then the ladies and gentlemen would get up there and they'd shake the dice cup and they'd roll the dice cup, and according to the way the dice rolled out, that's the way the symphony would be played. It would be played a different way each time, but the same idea would be unfolded in different ways.
Isn't the life in the interval?
Yes. That, again, is in the space. That the tones are embodiments for the truth of the life spirit, and this tone and that tone are separated in space, but the space is filled with the truth. Yes. Excellent point to make. These complex thoughts are called in the Rosicrucian Christian mysticism archetypes. And that is a very unfortunate word. It happens to be a correct word. It happens to be a correct word in the way that the ancient Greeks, the Platonists and others used that word. An archetype for them was a creative thought form. But somewhere in between, Carl Jung would eat his way in there, and Carl Jung uses archetypes, only he's not really clear about him. And his archetypes are more like universal ideas and not like creative thoughts. Don't worry about the word. Think about a resonant, creative form that is hollow to stuff but filled with truth, and you have the idea of an archetype. These archetypes are complex. They're compounded with each other, with thoughts. Now, the world of thought that we've been speaking about is only the realm of concrete thought. Similar to the way that the physical world is divided into the chemical region and the etheric region, the region of thought, the world of thought is divided into the region of concrete thought and the region of abstract, or I like the word I like better, is ideational thought, because not all abstraction is ideational. But ideas are always a holy thing. There's some kinds of empty abstraction that take place in that world of intellect that has little to do with reality, that has not a lot of inner meaning to it. The lowest region in the concrete thought is a region called the continental region. And the continental region relates to form. Any form that is produced in any of the other concrete realms first has its origin in the region of concrete thought. But most especially, since the chemical region is the realm of form in its finalized state, in its most completed state, there is a special relationship between the continental region of the world of thought and the concrete, dense physical world where the chemical interactions take place. So every form that is here, even like for these chairs and the continents of the world that we live in, are found in the archetypes of form in the continental region. It's all about form. And form is an experience. I don't know how to say it, but all forms have one thing in common, and that is form. But to understand form, you have to have the idea of form, which is universal, that applies to all of the concrete forms. But all of the concrete forms put together are in one massive concrete archetype in the region, a continental region. And so everything of form, including the earth itself, is found in the continental region. The next most subtle realm is called the oceanic region. Oceanic because it is fluid and surrounds the forms. And it has to do with concrete thoughts about life. Concrete forms, you know, like if we take and trim a hedge, like some of these hedges are trimmed here, or if we graft a tree, graft a branch of one tree onto another, we're only dealing with form. But when we can think and those thoughts become life and get within life and direct life, then we are working in the oceanic region. We have a very special connection with that, because in healing prayer, when we draw on the life spirit in our prayer, which is a concentrated kind of form, we are trying to bring the life of the etheric realm as the panacea. That living liquid gold that is so precious that it's, you know, you almost can't even think about it without going into tears. It's such a precious thing to work with that panacea. Every time we are in a healing prayer and we're trying to bring life in a way that's new and fresh and pure and that can heal as nothing else can heal, we're working in the oceanic region. Even if we're just become prayer mystics, we are doing something to promote our evolutionary growth. We're not just busy work people. Every kingdom has something it offers. The mineral kingdom gives us substantial form. Without the mineral kingdom, you know, my notes would be flying all over the place. The plant kingdom gives us life. If we don't have fresh plant food, we cannot continue to exist in the vital sense. The animal kingdom, through all the different species, gives us the range of the different kinds of desires we can have. But the service to the cosmos that humans give is thinking. And the sooner we set ourselves about thinking and get to work and do it, the more we are fulfilling our mission as human beings and as servants. So when we are praying, and we are trying to work in the oceanic region so that we can specialize the vital healing force, we are evolving. The aerial region is the next most rare region, and it is where we have concrete thoughts about emotions and desires. If we are psychologizing ourselves, if we are thinking about our emotional lives, and our emotional lives are pretty impoverished, we don't have a lot of different kinds of emotions very often. That's why it's a good thing to read poetry or to get the feel of the flowers. But every time, even if we're containing our so-called bad desires, we have to psychologize ourselves to be successful at that. And when we are doing that, what happens is we are thinking about desire in the aerial region of the concrete thought. And the more we can penetrate into the meaning of our emotions, it's like a seed. The thought is just the seed, but when it comes to fruit as an emotion in the desire world, it is elaborated and carried out to its fullest sense. Finally, the deepest region in the region of concrete thought, which is the center of the whole creation, is the region of archetypes. And it is where we have thoughts about other thoughts. When we think about logic, when we think about how people think, or if we follow somebody's line of thought, we are working in the region of archetypes. The world of thought is analogous to all of the other worlds. It sounds really far beyond us, but we can learn to perceive and be consciously awake and watching the thought process in the same way that we can have an emotional clairvoyance and see our emotions with an eye of feeling. We can see our thoughts with an eye or an ear of thinking.
How about the world of archetypes with medicine?
I think I'm going to pass on that because we're well overstayed already. We're way, way, way.
But it's a very practical one.
It's a very practical one, but it's way too much for us to go in. All of these archetypes last millions of years. Therefore, if we can perceive in the world of thoughts, we can perceive the thoughts that have created everything around us, and we can see the entire evolution and history behind it. This is called the memory of nature, where you can follow an individual, a spiritual focus, as it goes through many, many incarnations over thousands and thousands of years. What is available to us if we gain control of the mind by very simple concentration, very simple penetration, is utterly amazing. That's about as far as we're going to go today. We're quite overstayed, and we'll close with the Rosicrucian prayer, or the student's prayer, I'm sorry. O God, increase our love for Thee so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer.